Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Hello and welcome to the Bechdel cast. Oh, wait, I meant to do it a different way. Let me start over. Okay.
Oh.
Oh, hey there. And welcome to the Bechdel cast.
Oh, welcome to the Bechdel cast.
Oh, hey. I'm your host, Caitlin Durante.
I'm Jamie Loftus.
Oh, hey. Hey there.
That was a little bit New York.
Oh, yeah, it's really hard. I thought I would do better at this accent.
But... We'll lean into it. Yeah. We'll figure it out.
It's foreshadowing of the movie we're going to be talking about.
This is so clever of us.
I know. Oh, yeah. But before we get into that, we're going to just tell you a little bit about what the Bechdel cast is.
What is it?
It's a podcast where we talk about movies, but specifically, they're female characters.
Oh, yeah.
We pick a different movie every week, and we just talk and chat.
And then we also, at the end, when we remember, we decide if it passes the Bechdel test.
That's
which
right.
Which has everything to do with whether there are two female characters who speak to each other about something other than a man. Mm-hmm. There's a variation of it where the female characters have to have names.
Right.
Depending on the movie, we take it easy on some and really go in on the others.
Sure.
Yeah.
We can be ruthless.
Yeah.
And if you're wondering, hey... Who are these two people? And
yeah.
Why do they get to talk about
who
this?
Who or whom?
Well, yeah. I wonder if anyone ever is like, which one's talking? Oh, there's two ladies and their voices are too shrill.
We're brunette white ladies. We're the same lady.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm the one. It's me, Caitlin. It's me. And I have a lot of credentials. One, I have made several student films, at least three of them. Also, I do have 2 degrees in film.
Oh, my God.
I don't like to bring it up. I don't.
This is like the 50th time.
Well, you know, the people want to know.
The people
they're
want
asking.
To know. I used my degree this week, which is pretty amazing. My radio
what
degree.
Happened?
I know I never get to use it because it's an irrelevant medium, but I used it this week. I wrote some promos for a radio station.
Hey, there you go.
It took 3 years, but
did
I did
they,
it.
Did they pay you for it?
We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see if they come through.
Okay.
In theory, they should.
Yeah, if you do work, you should get paid for it.
Yeah, I have 1 degree, but I used it this week, so it counts
double. You're much further ahead than I am.
Swish.
But without further ado, let's introduce our guest.
Yeah.
She's a very funny person. She's a writer. She's a comedian. And her name is Julia Prescott.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
So you've brought us a movie that we're going to be talking about.
I'm
tell
so
us,
excited.
Tell us what it is.
Well, first and foremost, I must say my degree. I have a degree in in film studies from Chapman University. Interesting bit of trivia about my degree. I got into film school with an essay on the Coen brothers. Got out with a thesis on them, baby.
Oh yeah.
So they sandwiched my education.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is perfect.
Yes. Yeah. I'm so excited to talk about this movie. I did rewatch it, but I did feel before I rewatched, I was like, do I need to? Because I feel like I know it so well. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those movies. And then I also watched the TV series that it was based on.
I haven't seen that yet.
Me either. I've heard it's very good, though.
I've heard so many good things.
Such
yeah.
a treat. The movie is Fargo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The movie is Fargo.
The movie is Fargo. Which they probably knew because it's, I'm guessing, on the episode listing.
Keep everyone in suspense. They have to listen to know what movie we're talking about.
Can I just say something while I'm thinking about it? I didn't say my name yet.
Oh yeah, you should see your name.
Oh boy, now I feel full of hubris. But my name is Jamie. Okay, let's keep talking.
Okay. So, that accent is super fun.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I'm a real sponge for accents. Like, I'll be in Canada for like half a day and everything will be like,
I stopped doing it this afternoon. Like, I watched it this afternoon and then I came right here. I was feeling real Marge. I was channeling
you betcha.
Well, kind musicality. Like, there's like a real fun cadence to it that just, it opens the world up to you.
Yeah.
That's how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Well, yeah.
Well, yeah.
To answer your question from before, well, the reason why I brought this movie is because this movie had always stuck out to me. I think that for Coen Brothers fans, they love Raising Arizona. They love The Big Lebowski. You know, they love other ones. But I feel like this is a lot of Coen Brothers fans, like, first, this is the big drama movie that they really latch onto.
Mm-hmm.
And at least that was the way it was for me. And I was always a really big fan of film noir. I actually originally wanted to major as a cinematographer because I was like really into black and white cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
I was a really obnoxious 18 to 19 year old. But I got really into film noirs and then, got into Coen Brothers movies, which is neo-noir, and the way that they do it in this film, I think, is mwah. Just mwah. It's a spicy meatball.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
We were talking earlier about how it's virtually flawless.
Yeah.
Everything about it.
There's not a dull moment.
Yeah.
It's
mm-hmm.
so good. And it's full of limp-dicked men.
Yeah.
And, like, women who are doing their best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, a bunch of incompetent dudes and a bunch of very competent, well, not a bunch, at least one especially very competent woman.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that's a trend in a lot of Coen Brothers films in general, though. I mean, you see that with Raising Arizona and the character of High. You see that with, you know, a lot of their other films that it's sort of like the action of the story begins with an incompetent man spinning a lie that just gets them deeper and deeper and deeper. Mm-hmm. And of course, we see that in this movie with Jerry Lundegaard, played by William H. Macy.
Yeah.
Just being a total bumbling idiot. Like, I feel like you could, I mean, with the exception of No Country for Old Men and some of their later works aside, mm-hmm. like, you can count on any Coen Brothers movie where in, like, the first 5 or 10 minutes, if a plot is enacted of deceit or, you know, some sort of, like, get-rich-quick scheme, you know that it's not going to work out at all mm-hmm. because of this character's own misgivings.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
their ineptitude is going to get in the way. And, you know, and it's going to be very entertaining because they're going to have, like, sort of a folksy approach to it that is, like, very everyman, which I find really interesting.
Yeah. And with Jerry from moment one, like, he's late to the first scene. And then you're just like, oh, this guy does not have it together.
He doesn't have it together.
It's like 8:30.
Right. Yeah.
And the way that he's interacting with these two mob guys is so, I mean, it's indicative of where he comes from culturally with, like, you know, Fargo, North Dakota, and just being very like, you know, oh, hey, how you going? Oh, hey, you know, like, just being overly accommodating. But it also speaks to, like, his own ineptness of being a man, which is really what drives his plot and is, like, a central theme in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And they do it in the first 5 fucking minutes.
It's crazy.
It's so good. good.
Yeah. It's so well written. It's so well directed and acted. I know. Just like, oh, it's terrific.
And the way that they cast it, too. I mean, they do this for every one of their movies. They're so great at finding these amazing character actors. But I was just thinking about this, like, even in the scene with, like, the two escorts that Marge interviews to find out more about, you know, Steve Buscemi's character and Peter Stormare's character, like, they are such a specific kind of, like, North Dakota trashy girl. Mm-hmm. And, like, these aren't actresses that I've seen in any other movie. And I don't think, you know, I didn't check their IMDb, but I'm willing to bet they weren't in a lot of things. But they just, they acted so well and they were so real and it just, like, enhanced everything.
Yeah.
Well, we just found out right before you got here that Jean, the first thing she was ever in was Fargo because she's from there.
Wow, really?
Yeah, because like, I don't recognize her from anything else. And from what I can tell, she's the only, like, main cast member who is, like, absolutely from there, which makes, you know, her accent checks out. It's
what has she done after this?
She was in Drop Dead Gorgeous and Pleasantville.
Yes, I love those are two of my favorite, like, one of my favorite movies. Yeah, it's,
but her first thing ever was Fargo, so they must have just plucked her out of there.
Yeah,
I remember she was the pork products girl in Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Yeah.
I just love it. I work here now. Yeah, God, that fucking movie is one of the best movies of all time.
I haven't seen that movie in so
long. It's so good.
I've never seen it.
Oh my God, it's so, so good. Yeah, it was directed by one of the members of the state, and it was written by this woman who I don't know if she did a ton of movies after that. It was her first feature film. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a whole, like, BuzzFeed article written by Louis Peitzman that goes into, like, the behind-the-scenes, you know, rise of the cult of Drop Dead Gorgeous, and talks about, like, drama on set and, like, how it just kept changing due to studio notes, et cetera, et cetera. But it's actually out of print on DVD, so if you can find it on eBay, I highly recommend snatching that up.
And shout out to Peitzman.
I know.
What a doll.
He kills it.
What a great. Well.
Wow.
Okay.
Well, that's the podcast.
I think that's all we have to say.
I usually, to everyone's dismay, spend a few minutes describing the story of the movie that we're talking about.
Yes.
Just for anyone at home who doesn't need a refresher, who hasn't seen it before, or just likes my hilarious take on what that movie is about. So this is a story where we first, initially the central character is Jerry Lundegaard, played by William H. Macy. And he goes to these two professional criminals, and he's like, yo, kidnap my wife, because I'm in financial trouble, and we're going to do this whole fake ransom thing, but we both get paid out because my wife's husband, or I'm my wife's husband, that's what he said, my wife's father is wealthy.
Right.
So, like, yeah, cool, good idea. And then we meet his family and his wife and his father-in-law.
And the second you meet his wife, you're just like, don't kidnap this woman.
She's so nice.
She's so precious.
Yeah, like, at first it sounds fun to kidnap a lady, and you're just like, oh, maybe, you know, because I feel like we're conditioned to expect, like, oh, maybe she's mean. Maybe she's like,
right.
Maybe we're not going to love her the first time she opens her mouth.
She's but, the, like, most precious.
She's wonderful. You're like, don't.
Wonderful.
Who could want to lay a hand on this woman in a negative way?
And, like, I felt so sad for her in just seeing her in, like, her homemaker life of, like, sitting on the couch and watching, like, daytime TV and knitting. I was just like, oh,
and
girl.
She's so clearly settled for. I'm like, how did they meet? Like, I just.
Yeah. Ooh, maybe that's another season of Fargo.
Right? Because I don't know. Whenever I see her, I'm like, I know for sure you could have done better.
Yeah.
Than Jerry.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then we learn that Jerry's a very dishonest car salesman, and
he's a flaccid human being.
That's a great way to describe him. Yeah,
weenus. His wife gets kidnapped. They go off to take her to the lake, but before that, a cop pulls them over, and some murders happen. And they're like, "Oh crap! This didn't go. Things are not going as planned. Jerry, we need more money." And he's like, "Oh no, I don't have any more."
He couldn't even handle the first demand.
Yeah.
So things start to go awry. Then, after these murders happen, we meet Marge Gunderson. She's a detective, and she starts investigating these murders, and she connects a few things back to the dealership where Jerry works, and she starts to question him, and he is very bad at being questioned by police officers, and things keep heightening, and some violence happens, more people get murdered. including Jerry's father-in-law. They take her to the lake,
mm-hmm.
and then it ends with
Marge finding the Marge foot finding in the wood chipper. And she finds the tan Sierra.
Yeah. Oh, that's the car. That's the car.
Be careful, Marge. Be careful.
Yeah. I'm going to send some car. And then she shoots the bad guy in the leg. And she's like, yo, all this for a little bit of money, you stupid idiot.
She's so great.
She really is.
And then she goes home to her husband, Norm.
Norm, who's flaccid in all the right ways.
Oh. Yeah. Well, before you said that, I was going to say that it reminds me so much of me and my fiance.
Oh, no.
Not like that, though. No, it's just that I think he's an artist. And so I was teasing him, like, you're painting your duck paintings. You know, right. Hon, you know, we're just sweet to each other in a similar way.
That conversation at the end with the sweet 3-cent stamp.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, that's good, though, because people need those sometimes. And he's like, OK.
Yeah.
I do find myself like in situations where, you know, he's sort of down in the dumps about something creatively. I do find myself like finding the cadence of Marge going, yeah, but you're better than them, hon.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you're better than them.
And everyone needs
that
person.
You know. Yeah. So only the good parts. Shout out to Mike if you're listening. He knows.
S/O.
Yeah, I love that moment at the end with Marge. I mean, she's just so wise and she's so like confident in her like sort of matriarchal ways. And it's not like she's just kind but also smart. It's weird. It's like she can sort of succinctly boil everything down and get the answers. Like earlier when she's questioning Shep at his shop and being like, you know, like I looked into your background and you've got some infractions and you're on parole. And I'm just thinking like, you probably wouldn't want to be involved with like this being an accessory to crime now, would you? Like,
Badass. You
know, she's obviously playing a detective game, but there is still this like genuine like warmth to her.
Yeah,
and she actually cares about, like, she doesn't want people to go back on parole. She doesn't want people to go, you know, commit crimes and go back into jail. She wants the world to be good.
She's very nurturing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the reasons this movie is so great is that she is such, like, a strong, multi-dimensional character.
Yeah.
She's, like you said, smart. She's good at her job. She's really good at her job. She's very competent. She's, like, nice to a fault, but also, like, firm and assertive when she needs to be. Like, we see the scene with Mike Yanagita, and he's, like, very clearly trying to come on to her. And she's like, no, I prefer it if you sit over there.
I want to talk about that scene, because that scene, I don't know if you guys have found the controversy surrounding that whole subplot.
No, because I was about to say, I think that with any other character that wasn't as well developed as her, that would be very distracting from the main action. But I loved that scene because you just want to be like, how would someone deal with this? I don't know.
Right. Well, the internet has said a lot of people were saying like, why, you know, this film is so tidy in every other way, but this one subplot of Mike Yanagita like feels like it comes out of left field a little bit, and it doesn't really give as much oomph to the motor of the plot as like some of the other aspects of it. And, you know, like, why is it even in there? You know, what does it do? And I disagree. I think that, I mean, I trust Papa and Papa Cohen. I trust that they're going to carry us on to that sweet good night. They're just such competent directors. So I know that they know what they're doing. But I also, you know, feel like the Mike Yanagita character, everything has a domino effect of her investigation. So she gets the phone call from him and then knows that he's in the Twin Cities, then hears that, you know, the people that she's after went to the Twin Cities. Okay, great. So that gives me a little bit more incentive to go, even though on paper you could say that, like, oh, is she, you know, thinking about like philandering on Norm, you know? But I don't think it's as complex as that. I think that she's curious to find out, like, you know, what this guy's life's been like. But I think that also that scene of them at the diner or the Radisson or whatever it is, you know, she believes his story of his wife.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And then immediately he confesses and says that that was a lie. So that
he doesn't confess. She
finds out later.
She has
a phone call with a
friend. And,
but it's not long after.
Right.
Yeah. But that whole process of her believing him and then realizing that she was wrong forces her to start to question some of her instincts previously. And it actually leads her back to William H. Macy's character.
Right.
And to question him for the second time.
So it does connect back into
it. It does connect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ooh, very insightful. Michael. Good job.
Thank you so much.
What do you have, a thesis on the Coen brothers?
I have a thesis on the Coen brothers. I majored in film studies.
I thought that was interesting because it was interesting to watch this movie in the context of this podcast and really pay attention to the motivations of the female characters, because there is sort of like a through line of like the idea of women settling for men that don't deserve them. Because I feel like Mike implies that when they're chilling at the Radisson, where he's like, "Oh, you ended up marrying Norm,
son of a Gunderson."
Yeah. And that makes it sound like he thought she could do better. Mm-hmm. And I mean, for anyone, that's enough to plant a, you know, it's a downer to hear the person that you married and are pregnant with, someone you respect thinks is like a loser or whatever. But she and Norm have such a great relationship, and it's nice to see her go through that whole process of like, no, this is the right thing for me and this is what I want.
Totally. Well, I think you're tapping into something actually that I kind of picked up in this rewatch of, you know, there is a moment when, you know, she is at the buffet with Norm and like one of her colleagues comes over and is like, "Oh, you're going to the Twin Cities, eh?" And she's like, "Yeah, I'm going." And then Norm's is like, kind of surprised.
Oh,
really?
Yeah?
Oh, yeah? Yeah. So there is just a flash of a moment of her sort of exploring, has she settled? Just a flash of it.
Right.
And I think that that's also a symptom of small towns in general. Like if you work in a small town, if you live in a small town, have I settled? Have I really seen my full potential? I think that there is a flicker of that that leads us to that Frank meetup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I know.
I wish
it's
that
so
we,
hard not to do it.
I wish that we had that moment with Jean, because, I mean, I don't know. Jean's the other female character of any substance in this movie. And we don't really get to see much of her thoughts other than the fact that she's very clearly duped.
Mm-hmm.
I wish, the one thing that I would have liked to have from this movie is at some point after her kidnapping that she would get to say something.
Yeah.
And I was bummed. I mean, it was fun to watch her run around like a chicken with her head cut off. That's an amazing scene and like tragic, but also like,
yeah,
Buscemi was right. It's
Buscemi,
funny.
Yeah. Buscemi's character, good lord.
Oh, Jesus,
I love
Christ.
Him so
he's
much.
He's so good. I love how people keep calling him ugly the entire movie.
He's funny looking.
Yeah.
Funny looking.
You know, just, but I can't describe how.
Yeah, exactly.
Rumor has it that in The Big Lebowski, the reason that everyone's always telling Steve Buscemi's character in that film, Donnie, to shut the fuck up is that he doesn't ever shut the fuck up in Fargo.
That's funny. I think I heard that a while ago. Yeah, that's hilarious. I thought you were going to be like, because he's dead and he shouldn't be talking. I'm like, oh, God.
Another thing about The Big Lebowski is a similar thing happens in The Big Lebowski. It does with like the Mike Yanagidis subplot in Fargo. There's just like a character that feels tacked on, but you're like, I'm okay with this. But like the Jesus character that, oh my God, what's his name?
Oh, yeah. John Turturro?
Yeah,
that's actually been, I've heard theories about like, what's that all about?
There's a bar in, I think, I want to say Germany, that is like themed. It's called Lebowski Bar, and the only drink they serve there is White
Russians.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Cool.
In Los Angeles. Have you guys heard of Cafe Jack?
The Titanic one.
The Titanic.
Yes, I love
restaurant.
It. Oh,
I've
been.
And they serve like,
it's great.
What do they serve? It's like fried chicken and weird.
Yeah, it's like deeply weird American food that is not that good, but worth it.
Worth it.
For the experience.
And then you go to karaoke afterward. It's a good time.
Great. I very, very unapologetically love the movie Titanic.
I
hope we do it on this podcast sometime, because I love it so much.
There was my mom, the first time I saw that movie, because I wasn't old enough to see it when it came out, but eventually my mom had the two VHSs for Titanic, and she tried to convince me the movie was over at the end of the first VHS, because the first half is so fun.
Yeah.
And then at the end, it's
that's
the captain saying, like, we hit an iceberg. And she's like, and that's the movie.
That's the movie.
I was like, you're lying to, like, yeah. And then
that's the inciting incident, pretty much.
Yeah.
Right, but it just happens to happen 2 hours into the movie.
I love the second half of the movie.
I love the whole movie.
I love the whole movie, but I really, to me, the second half of that film is just so, like, as soon as it hits the iceberg, I'm like, oh, now it's getting good.
I'm gonna blow both your minds for a little bit. last year, I think, on tour, I went to the Titanic Museum.
Where, in Florida?
In Pigeon Forge, Tennessee.
There are so many.
I know. Ugh. This one shares a location. Their sister location is in Branson, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And I lied and said that I was covering it for a Vice article. And they were like, that seems weird, but come on board. And it was so bizarre and so fantastic. The kind of like roadside weird attraction that I just like salivate over. And when you go there, it's like, if you've ever been to Pigeon Forge, people in this room and also people listening, it is like hillbilly Vegas. So Dollywood's there, obviously.
I love Dollywood. Yeah.
Yeah. But then everything like leading up to Dollywood is like wax museums and like go-karts and like, you know, here's a weird boat ride. I don't know. And then here's like the Titanic Museum and then a Walmart. And you show up and they give you a card and they assign you to somebody that was actually on the Titanic. That's then you like walk through and have to figure out if you survived, which is like they do at the Museum of Tolerance too.
Yeah. That's how the one in, I've been to the one in Orlando several mm-hmm. times, the Titanic Museum there. Did you get to touch ice?
I did get to touch ice.
Okay, this must be the same
thing. It must be the same.
It's awesome. I never
And they have a kid area that feels weird. It feels inappropriate.
Yeah, like, oh, this is the
like
fun
like a playground.
Part.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But and they were so strict about taking photos, and I respected that.
Yeah, I had like a digital camera when I was 15, and I went, and I tried to like sneak it, but they were all blurry because it was a bad camera. But mm-hmm. when you get into the room with the grand staircase, you're just like, this is
it's a big moment. And I got my photo taken, and I feel great about it.
Me too. Yeah. I wish that I
was alone.
So weird looking then.
I am
probably similarly weird looking.
Seething with jealousy that you guys have done all this.
There's one in Massachusetts too.
Oh, it's so crazy. It's and also the gift shop is rude. Can we agree? It's, the gift shop's super rude.
But that said, I purchased things.
I know. I was contemplating getting a really rude t-shirt that said Titanic 1912.
I was determined.
Property of, like it's a gym shirt. Titanic.
Right. Property. I was determined when I was a teenager to be on, I think that they, I'm pretty sure they did have like a centennial voyage.
Oh boy.
Because I used to be really into Titanic from like a historical perspective.
Yeah.
I was like,
sure.
It's not because I liked the movie, but it was. Mm-hmm. And I would go out onto my roof every April 14th to 15th in that morning, and sure. I would sit there and just like think real hard about the losses that had transpired.
I thought you were gonna say like you spread out your arms and said, "I'm the king of the world."
But back to Fargo.
Yes,
oh yeah,
we've gone on a tangent.
We should do Titanic.
Yes, we yeah. should.
And soon.
Mm-hmm. One of my thoughts is that a very interesting happens in this movie that usually does not happen in any movie, where the protagonist shifts from one character to another.
Yeah.
Take any screenwriting 101 class, and I'll tell
That's
you not to
not
do that.
That's not supposed to happen
but
yeah. at the beginning of the second act.
The Coen brothers are very good at what they do. They pull it off very well. Because we start identifying and relating to and like even feeling a bit empathetic toward Jerry Lundegaard.
He loses me the second I see his wife. That was the thing. It was like, I like him in the first scene. And then the second you see Gene, you're just
yeah.
like, this yeah. guy fucking sucks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because yeah, like, again, like what you were saying earlier, if his wife, not to say that this excuses any kind of abuse, but, you know, as far as like what we understand in movies, if the wife is like very shrewish and like, you know,
right. yeah.
quote unquote deserving. No one's deserving. Well, you know what I mean? Like it adds a little bit more validation to what he's struggling with.
Yeah, like we're conditioned to think.
Or
you know.
It just helps us understand why he would put the steps to do
sure.
what he's about to do.
Right. And it's just like, well, he must have a reason for...
Yeah.
But he.
But she's
it's
so
just money.
Wonderful, and he's
like,
such a slime.
She's
yeah.
wonderful.
Yeah, the like little monologue, the speech that Marge gives at the end to Peter Stormare's character
yeah.
should really be directed to
yeah.
Jerry Lundegaard.
Jerry, yeah.
But yeah, you do lose empathy for him pretty early on. But he's still the central character for a good half hour.
Yeah.
Until the murders happen, the three murders in Brainerd, and then we meet Marge. Then she, you're like, oh, okay, she's the main character now. And then, oh, what a delight she is.
I know, she's so fantastic.
Which we've already talked about. But it's like the slimier Jerry gets, like he just keeps, every scene you see him in, he's lying to someone, he's manipulating someone. He's trying to get his way, and he's
throwing
so incompetent.
A fucking tantrum. He
yeah.
throws multiple tantrums.
Several.
And every single time you're just like,
This is your fault.
Yeah, and also, like, I was frustrated from him from a criminal perspective of, like, you look so fucking guilty right now, throwing a tantrum in your translucent office.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, we understand, you know, the steps that he took to get to, like, this low place because he's such a terrible car salesman. He can't, like, sell, you know, one feature on
that
his
whole
car.
Scene, yeah, when he's just,
true
like,
coat.
Lying.
Oh, you're going to want that true coat.
It's like, oh, but you didn't say it, you know? It's like, and I understand who that outraged customer is. I've seen them in life. I've been them. You know, I understand Jerry and and just like showing that, oh, he's lying, like, oh, I'm going to go talk to my boss. And he just asks him about the game and then comes back. It just, everything makes sense. You're like, man, you shouldn't be doing this. And that's also, I'm not going to spoil anything with the TV series. You should definitely check it out. Both of them are works of art. They really are. The first one has Billy Bob Thornton in it as like the bad dude. Terrifying. One of the more I mean,
Billy
just
Bob
imagine
rules.
He's the best.
I'd wear a vial of his blood.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Can we get that on Etsy now?
Yeah.
I feel like we can. With a divorce, maybe she's taking up hobbies. But so the main character in the Fargo series, it's sort of a similar situation of William H. Macy's character, where instead of being a used car salesman who's inept, he's like an insurance salesman.
Okay.
So you kind of see like a similar pattern of like these kind
That's
of
funny.
Like, you know, emasculated men like trying to live up a life that, you know, they feel entitled to, but, you know, have no talent to achieve.
I think one of the interesting male characters that I didn't think about a lot before this, like, rewatching was Wade. Wade is the dad.
Yeah.
Wade. Because, I don't know, like, I remember the first time I saw this movie, I was surprised at how sad I was when he's killed.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of took me off guard because the whole time I was like, well, kind of every guy in this movie is an asshole. But he was a well-intentioned enough asshole.
Yeah, he really cared about his daughter and getting his daughter back. Whereas...
Right, but that said, he also, what did not sell me on him was that scene in the diner where he's talking to Jerry and he's like, well, I don't want to give $1 million. Like, maybe I can give $500,000.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, Jerry is the real shit heel of that scene because he's like, no, you got to give all the money, and he's lying. But even like Wade saying, I don't know, I just like tried to think, I was like, if my dad had $1 million, amazing, first of all. But like, I would not want him to be haggling for my life.
Right.
Like that that bugged me.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you want, but also I guess, I don't know, you don't know the things. I kind of sympathize with him in that moment a little bit too, because you don't know like the back and forth of that kind of mental gymnastics of like, are we even going to get what we pay for, technically, of like getting her back? Is she going to be okay? We don't have any evidence that she's still alive. We're definitely being duped in some way.
Sure.
It's fucking tough.
It's, I mean, he's in an impossible situation. And you hate Jerry even more when you see Scotty crying in that scene.
I know.
Like, what's going to happen to
he
mom?
He didn't even think about his son throughout all of this.
No.
And in the parking lot, it's like,
oh, right, I have a son. And
oh,
he's probably
Scotty.
Upset
you
that
literally
I
see it occur to him.
Mother,
That his son would, of course, be terrified.
Which is, like, the most believable, like, face that he gives to being grieved in the entire, you know, movie. So I was like, oh, well, good on you. You at least got that scene, Jerry.
Right. That's the one, because, oh god, the scene that always like raises my blood pressure is the scene right after he sees that Jean has been kidnapped and he's practicing how to tell Wade.
I know.
You're just like,
And the button on that scene is amazing because he's like working up this fake emotion to be like, Wade, it's Jerry, something terrible has happened.
So,
and then
nasty.
He makes the phone call and then he's like, you can see him like gearing up to be emotional, and then he has to be like, Wade Gustafson or whatever.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Because he got the receptionist or whatever.
Yeah, which, I mean, can incriminate him too, because they can go back and get the recordings from the phone calls that he made to sort of see, I don't know, whatever.
He's super fucking Dateline guilty. That it's like, if I wanted to commit a murder, I've seen enough Dateline that I think I could get away.
Yeah, you think so? Yeah.
Well, you're just like, he's making a lot of rookie-ass mistakes.
He is,
Well,
With Wade's character negotiating or haggling with the ransom, I think that actually kind of speaks to the duplicitous of his character, of like him being this sort of like very shrewd, very tough kind of character who we see this tender side when it comes to his daughter being in danger. But then that toughness and that kind of like unfair shrewdness comes back with him trying to haggle. I think that that kind of shows the back and forth of his character maybe a little bit.
And we do see both sides of him, of like there are scenes where he's strictly a businessman and strictly a father and grandfather. Like that scene where he is like, Gene and Scotty will never have to worry.
I love that.
That was when I really liked him because I was like, yeah, fuck Jerry.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for how inept and slimy and terrible Jerry is, Marge is the op. Like,
she's
just
so fantastic.
So, like, the first clue you get that she's good at her job is she and her colleague, I think his name is Lou, Detective Seibert or whatever, they're at the crime scene where the trooper and the two other people who witnessed the murder are all killed and they're dead in the snow. And he's like, oh, yeah, he must have started writing it down and didn't get the whole license plate. And she's like, no. She's like, oh, I'm not so sure about your detective work there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I love that scene. And she's like, it was clearly a dealer plate. And he's like, oh.
Yeah, and even when she's correcting him, it's not condescending.
Right, yeah.
She's so kind about it.
And I feel like in a lot of movies, powerful females is often, conflated with, and she's also really mean.
Yeah, she's
having, she doesn't have friends, and she's, very
devil
dominant
and she wears
in all
Prada.
Her relationships.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, even in her relationship with Norm, it seems like a very equal partnership, even when in my head I was like, oh, Marge, you're in charge, right?
Yeah.
But she doesn't treat it that way, and she's, genuinely very kind. She cares about people, and she's great at stuff. And, mm-hmm. I feel like you don't see that very often. It's very easy to just say, oh, if you're good at your job, you're also bad at your personal life.
Right.
Yeah. I think also with that particular kind of job, there tends to be, a misconception that you have to be detached from human emotions in that way because you're seeing a lot of blood and guts and you have to sort of come to terms with that and reconcile that in yourself that you're not constantly throwing up over or you're not bringing your work home in your brain, to kind of have it live with you and haunt you. But she seems very adept. Yeah.
Oh, that scene where she throws up, she's about to throw up. Yeah. And I was like, oh, is it because she's looking at a dead child? And she's like, no, it's just morning
sickness.
I'm going
to barf.
Yeah.
I think a lot of cops in movies are portrayed as, I'm a tough guy and everyone's guilty and until proven innocent. And she just hopes for the best in people.
Yeah,
wants them to be good. And then when they're bad, she's so disappointed.
I feel that increases the impact of how disappointed she is at the end of the movie. You're just what can we tell you, Marge?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I also want to talk about how, her relationship with Norm and how, the gender roles of their marriage are very reversed.
Yes.
And that, he is a artist / house husband, I'm guessing. From what little we know about him.
He goes fishing. He needs night crawlers.
Yeah. But he, makes her breakfast.
Norm? Yeah.
He brings her lunch. He's taking care of her in a way that meal providing, which is very stereotypically
it's hard to not fall in love with a woman's role.
Yeah.
But you're she's out there working and you're making her breakfast and it's just great.
I'm just get me one of those.
Yeah.
Ding ding ding, I got one.
Yeah.
Okay.
You won the lotto.
Right. Though Mike has never brought me lunch and has never
Arby's in the middle of the day.
He's never cooked me breakfast.
What's extremely this Arby's?
Rude.
Arby's.
I wanted to eat Arby's so bad.
Oh my gosh.
I know. So disgusting.
Dude, when he says, I'll cook you eggs and then hawks up a loogie, you're just like,
and she
you know
smiles.
What? I know. She's
that
like,
smile.
That's my boy.
Oh, she loves him so much.
But he loves her too. It's great.
Yeah.
Something I wanted to, I was thinking about the whole movie in regards to William H. Macy's character is, I kept drawing a comparison in my head, I don't know why, to American Beauty and how many things Fargo does right that American Beauty, I think, does wrong.
Ooh, spell.
I don't like that movie at all, but it came out a couple of years after Fargo, I think mm-hmm. 99, and it's all, they have a similar character of the frustrated husband trying to blow off steam, but I hate how American Beauty, paints Kevin Spacey as this very tragic figure. And then you're just like, no, this guy's a fucking jerk and a pervert.
Yeah.
There's no excuse for this person. And the whole idea of life in the suburbs is so suffocating. And I don't know. I'm just like, shut the fuck up. You're fine. Whereas William H. Macy's character is portrayed as what I view those types of people to be, which is pathetic and kind of sad.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like William H. Macy's character is the frustrated husband who's trying to get his life together and is punished fairly and portrayed fairly as like, this guy does not know what he's doing. He's certainly not the hero of the story. I don't know. Like, I couldn't stop thinking about American Beauty and, oh no, and how, I don't know, like, it's always bothered me that Kevin Spacey's portrayed as sort of like a tragic martyr.
Right.
In that, when he's just a fucking piece of shit.
I have a theory about that. I think that, so 99, there's also an article that came out a while ago, I think it's from AV Club, that talked about like the craziest year for movies in the 21st century was like 1998 or something, because it just was a huge year of Titanic and like The Phantom Menace, and it was just like there was a lot of spotlight happening on feature films at the time. But American Beauty, I feel, is like at the epicenter of this trend of this sort of like, I wouldn't say faux artsiness, but definitely artsiness in the forefront. And I think that it's attributed to the rise of the mid-budget movie through Miramax and through Quentin Tarantino.
Interesting.
And like that becoming more a part of like what the mainstream could be, and that people were kind of opening their doors, at least the Academy was, to like films that maybe they quote unquote didn't quite understand, but like acknowledged as art. And I feel like American Beauty like perfectly epitomizes that. I mean, with just that drifting plastic bag plot of the most beautiful thing in the whole world. I mean, which we now roll our eyes because it's like first year art school bullshit.
Yeah.
But at the time, I think was captivating a lot of people because they didn't understand it. And so I think that a lot of people attribute like good art to something that they just don't understand.
Right. And that's something that I feel like is almost universally agreed does not hold up very much at all.
Oh, yeah.
And also with, I don't remember the character's name, but Kevin Spacey's wife in that
Annette Bening
movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like she's portrayed, I mean, she's a developed character, but she's still ultimately portrayed as like a shrewish person. And I'm just, I don't know. I'm like grateful that Jean is not portrayed that way.
You're
like,
yeah.
Jean is doing her best. So is Annette Bening's character, but I feel like the story just paints her as sort of deserving.
You're getting C grades. Like, she just wants... She also just wants the best.
It caused her pain to tell her son he couldn't go out for hockey.
I know.
You mentioned, like, whenever Marge is correcting her colleague on his, like, his police work, she doesn't do it in a condescending way. There is a scene, though, where she is very condescending, but it's to someone who very much deserves it. And I don't know if you, like, perceive this way or not, but whenever she first meets Jerry in his office, she's like, oh, you the owner here? And he's like, no, I'm just the executive sales whatever.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, okay. And then he's like, my father-in-law. He's like clearly trying to like push blame off onto someone else.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh yeah, okay, well, I'm a police officer. And it's like like she talks to him like he's so dumb.
That's the second meeting, right? Or no, it's the first meeting. Yeah, no, I remember that.
And
she's amazing.
She's just like, you're an idiot, so I'm going to talk to you like you are one. I think it's the second meeting where she says something like, oh, this crime I'm investigating, the perps were driving a car with dealer plates, and they called someone who works here at this dealership, so it would be quite a coincidence if they weren't, you know, connected.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, she's just like, it's so great how much she condescends to such a piece of shit that Jerry Lindegaard is. And I love watching that scene because he is trying so hard to like be like, I'm cooperating, and like to be like cool and chill, and he's so
just barely holding it together that entire scene.
Yeah,
where, like, those long periods of silence. I'm like, well, you're done, Jerry.
Yeah. like you are so guilty. Like you have no. I want to watch this guy play poker because he'd just be like, oh.
Can I say like, what my favorite part about that scene is?
And
this speaks directly to what I was saying earlier about being a cinematography nerd. Similar to in Psycho, we see Janet, what's her face's character's name, the main lady in Psycho.
Yeah.
We see her in her like negligee at first, and it's white and pure when she's like hooking up with her dude. And then later when she decides that she's going to, you know, steal the money from her boss and like run out, her negligee is black to, you know, represent that she's now evil and she's corrupt.
Right. I never caught on to
this. She's turned. So in a similar way, these two scenes, if you face them together, the scene of Marge first visiting Jerry and the scene of the second one. So I feel like this was calculated and strategic from the filmmakers that there are vertical blinds in his office. Because in the first scene, they're open, it's bright, he's, you know, seemingly passing off this lie to her, it's totally fine. Second scene, the light is casting over the vertical blinds representing prison bars Whoa. On Jerry Lundegaard's face, and he's done for. And shortly after that, he sprints off, takes one of the cars, and she realizes, oh, he's gone!
He's fleeing the interview.
He's fleeing the interview. Yeah, so that was a little bit of thing. That was like a little bit of trivia.
Baby.
Yeah, baby. I was like, that's good. Like, it just was so fun. I love stuff like that, and that's part of the reason why I wanted to go in that line of work, and why I never will. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe there's time.
There's time.
Yeah, you can do anything.
There's time.
Yeah. We're women, and we can do whatever we want
in society.
I guess so.
Therefore, I want to keep riding. If they'll let me. If they'll allow.
The final thing that I want to talk about, unless I think of something else, is Marge does everything that she does while she's like 7 months pregnant.
So that's highly symbolic as well. Yes.
Tell me of what.
I shall. So, you know, here they are. They're basically, I mean, we'll get into if this passes the Bechdel test eventually, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've never heard of it.
Oh, okay.
What are you talking about?
So this world is littered with dudes. It's lousy with dudes. And so Marge is really like this big female figure in that, not just because there's not too many other people besides Jean that she can kind of rap with and like the other escorts, but they wanted to make her this like matriarch that sort of carried and saved this plot, and having her also be pregnant really enhanced that kind of maternal instinct that was a requirement for her instinct as a detective to get down to the case. Like, it not only signified that she was like a protector of this town, a protector of justice, but she's, you know, literally protecting life and preserving life. And those are like her motivations. You know, she wants people to be good, so she's protecting life for like their livelihood. She wants people to not die, so literally protecting life in that way. And as she's 7 months pregnant and like fucking doing it like a badass, it just further proves that she's going to be the one that carries this.
Yeah, and like the scene, it's so like interesting, the scene where she looks at the dead child.
I know.
And she's 7 months pregnant, and then she's about to throw up, and you're like, oh, that makes
sense. I was like,
when
does that happen? But okay, I remember when you said that.
And it's like, but that to me is like a testament of like, no, she is really good at her job, and she's able to compartmentalize accordingly.
Yeah.
Which is
a superpower.
Jealous.
It's a true superpower, I believe.
Not quite there.
Yeah.
But and the fact that she's also like, even though she is very pregnant and that's important to her, she's not compromising the job she's doing that's
right.
kind of dangerous. Well, it is dangerous, and she's not compromised. Like, she doesn't compromise in any regard ever,
which is
amazing.
I know.
And
she's incredible.
She's the best.
When pregnant women are portrayed in, like, movies and TV, it's almost always, like, they are cranky and hormonal and they're like, oh, what a delicate flower I am, oh, I have to pee all the time, and
right.
like I'm
hungry.
I will never
and
be pregnant,
like,
and
bitch.
I not have been yet, so I have no idea what it's like, and I'm sure it is very uncomfortable, but like, you can still carry on with your life in your job
being
pregnant, but like, it's almost always when you see a very pregnant woman on screen, it's like, oh, look how pregnant I am. It's the only thing I can think about and talk about.
They're like sort of damselfied.
Yeah.
And it's,
And
like,
I mean, it's like,
little flowers.
Barring medical conditions, most pregnant women work
up until they give birth in their office, often, I've heard. Oh, there's a Harmon Town show happening. Oh,
dear God. Chills.
Yeah.
Chills. I'm like, Dan, why is Harmon a man yelling during our podcast?
So I just love that she mentions it, but it, or she's like, do you mind if I sit down? I'm carrying quite a load. And that's pretty much the only
the most
time
polite she gets in a way.
Yeah. And the only time really that her pregnancy affects her performance.
Yeah.
Right.
Apart from the time that she keels over to almost barf.
Yeah.
But then I love how she's like, oh, it passed and now I'm hungry again.
Right, yeah. Right. And then she goes back to work.
Yeah, she goes back to work. And then, oh, I love how many times you see her eating in the movie,
know,
too.
It's so great.
She's eating Arby's. You don't see her eating the eggs.
She's going to town on that buffet.
The buffet.
And it's so, like, representative of that region of, like, these comfort foods, these heavy, heavy sausages. And can we talk about, like, the choice to make this, like, murder plot in this folksy setting a little bit? Because I love that the Coen brothers did this. And I do think that it allows for that comedy to just sort of naturally happen. I mean, obviously, it's like mismatched to what the actions are. You wouldn't suspect. And I think that even in like the tagline on the poster, it was like a murder mystery, like a homespun murder mystery or something that sort of like, you know, let you know that this is going to be this offbeat, kooky kind of like, we don't know what we're in for. We're in way over our heads kind of town. And one would suspect that like a small town wouldn't have the resources to deal with solving a murder, but they don't have Marge. but I found there's this book that I really like called The Philosophy of the Coen Brothers, and it is edited by Mark T. Kennard, who is this like really super boss film critic, but each chapter is like an assemblage of essays from different film critics. And so I forget the name of the gentleman who wrote a chapter about modernity and noir in Fargo, but I found it really interesting because, of course, you know, any film genre is representative of social anxiety. You know, we see that a lot with science fiction. Right. You know, science fiction represents social anxiety about like progress. And then you can kind of actually divide the genre into like two different chapters, pre-Cold War and post-Cold War. And that post-Cold War deals a lot with like nuclear attacks and like the fear of that, and that's like sort of what the menace is with it. And I feel like with noir, they kind of tap into that kind of social anxiety through modernity, because with that comes like you're making progress, but with progress you are breaking off from the past. So with that becomes this loneliness and isolation and alienation, and that a lot of noirs, especially ones that define the genre in the 40s, took place in like these urban cities escapes, which could be comforting but also isolating as well, because if you're like this one person walking around the cityscape, you've got these skyscrapers looming over you, making you feel like you can either like be protected by them or trampled by them. Right. And so what the Coen brothers do, and what, you know, they actually, what this author suggests, they kind of took a page from Orson Welles in Touch of Evil, bringing the noir to the desert and to Mexico, is that they are jarring the audience from what is known to be noir in the city. And by taking it to this like desolate landscape that's snow covered, you know, it's different than what we expect. But I also really love it because, you know, we know that there's a danger. The danger is lurking. However, everywhere we look, we think we see everything that there is to see. It's this blank canvas. You know, it's these large expanses of land. Where could the danger be hiding? And I think that that was a very smart choice that they made to raise the tension of where is it going to pop out? What are we doing? And also the fact that it is snow covered, I feel like speaks to like how flimsy the foundation of what all the things that we are to believe are resting on, the flimsy foundation of all the characters and their intentions and how it can change at any minute. That to me was interesting.
Yeah.
Beautiful. It's like a real, maybe this is like a political climate thing that's influencing this, but it seems like a real like American movie, and it's like a side of the country you don't see in movies a lot at all, and it almost feels like a non-judgmental depiction of like a very American place where it's like, yeah, there are good people and there are bad people, but it is what it is. It's not necessarily making a very overt commentary on it. It's just like presenting it in what feels like a pretty like cool and honest way that you don't see a lot.
Yeah. That's nice. And I think that it being like this sort of more realistic environment like raises fears in people watching it, that it feels closer to home than watching like two people buzz around a city.
It's not sexy crime fighters. No one in this movie is particularly
sexy. Is
no one gets me horny in this entire movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And the sex is also like, the sex scenes that we see are not fetishized in any way. They're not romantic
in
any way.
They're always Steve Buscemi.
They're always Steve Buscemi. But also, like, the people that are having the sex don't seem to particularly enjoy it.
Oh, my God. I love the prostitutes dialogue in this, where at some point she's like basically mocking Buscemi while she's fucking like, all right, wrap it up. Wrap it up. Loving like, this. Or no, she is like, I'm bells. Hearing bells.
Yeah. I know. And I at like, dinner earlier, great. And he's nice. He's taken her to dinner. Like he's paid her for the evening. Mm-hmm. They don't technically have to go out. They can just do what he paid her for. Being very delicate in my word choice. But, you know, he tries to relate to her and tries to have a conversation, and she like judges him and like,
well, she's like, what are you talking about?
Do you like this kind of work?
Yeah, or? Do you like being a prostitute? And she's like, what? what a dumb question.
Yeah.
But that kind of leads us to the question of whether or not this movie passes the Bechdel test.
There is allegedly some controversy.
Apparently, which I did not know about. I, using my dumb old brain, have decided that...
You got a great brain.
Oh, thanks so much. I have the best brain.
I feel
that.
It's true.
As far as I'm concerned, it does pass the Bechdel test because there is a scene where Marge is questioning the two young women who are women and ladies of the night about the two guys that they spent the night with. Before they move on to that subject, though, they're talking about where the two women went to college and where they went to high school.
Yeah,
and she's like, "Go Bears!" And like, so it's a sliver of a conversation. But to me, I would say that
like
counts.
Most of the movies we have let pass, it passes on a technicality.
Even though the whole reason why they're talking is because of these two guys,
right?
I
can see it both ways.
Also, I feel like. And I'm purely speculating here, but I feel like the Bechdel test was designed to question whether or not the women... The assumption is that if they are talking about a man, it's because he's the romantic interest of someone.
Right.
So this
their
is,
purpose
me,
derives from that man.
It is a work conversation.
Right. Yeah, it's... Yeah, so they happen to be talking about men, but it's in the context of, like, a criminal investigation rather than, like, yes, we love these men. Oh, well, do they love me back?
Right.
Oh.
Yeah. I agree.
I'm inclined to give it a pass just because... the Bechdel test is certainly flawed in that I feel like this movie is pretty unequivocally, has amazing female characters. And maybe there aren't enough of them per se, but I almost feel like that's intentionally done in the case of this because Marge just is this force of good and badassness in a sea of flaccid men.
Yeah.
She's so strong that I think she alone makes up for it. Like,
Exactly.
She's not, her purpose doesn't derive from a man, and her self-worth isn't defined by how men perceive her at all. In fact, she doesn't seem to register it.
Right.
She doesn't care.
Yeah.
I mean, we see it for a flash when she gets all, you know, done up to see her old pal, but I think that that's just her wanting to have a break for a moment to, like, you know,
that's like
have
such
an excuse.
Human, I feel like that, it's such a human moment of, like, I mean, any marriage, there comes a moment where there's, like, that thought of, like, oh, what if? And then she seems to pretty immediately snap back into, like, oh, no, I made the right decision.
Yeah.
And that's awesome to see, almost. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, and I just think in general of just, like, having an excuse to, like, I don't know, not play act necessarily, but just, like, to get gussied up and to just explore a path for a night, even if it's just a thought for a second.
Right, especially, like, with the she's about to become a mother and there's about to be this big change. It's almost like a last kind of, like,
hurrah.
Yeah,
I agree.
But then he's like, oh, I'm going to sit over here and put my arm around you.
I know,
and then she's
creepy.
Like, get away from me.
Yeah. How would
well, that's a creepy fucking move.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been in similar situations where it's like super awkward.
Never sit on the same side.
And I love how she passes it off as like,
doing?
Oh, I just don't want to have to turn my neck. But it's like clearly that's a front for how she like registered that as, oh, that was weird.
Yeah.
Go back
you
over to the other
side. You are troubled.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he sounded so manic on the phone when we first hear him, and it's just bad.
Well, I think now is the time where we, on a scale of 0 to 5 nipples, we rate the movie based on its treatment and portrayal of its female characters.
This is our alternative to the Bechdel test.
Yes.
Yeah, the 5 nip rating.
Yeah.
Well, who would like to go first?
I can go first.
Sure.
Yeah. I would give it... Without knowing any precedent of how you've rated previous films and where you personally reside in, like, the parameters of that, I would give it a 4.5.
That's...
Because I would give it a 5 just on Marge alone, because she's so iconic as a strong female character. And I think that a lot of people have referenced her through other characters written after this as like sort of the goal of what you can achieve with like a woman who is in control and is dynamic and interesting and all of that stuff. However, you know, take away a 0.5 because a lot of the other female characters are escorts that we don't know too much about. And Jean isn't really given a perspective, unfortunately.
I wish Jean had like one more. I wanted Jean to have that moment.
We know that she knits.
I know, but there's more to her.
There's more to her. So, yeah, unfortunately, 4.5.
Could you describe those nipples? Sorry, we should have. We usually describe 4.5 nipples.
They're like, you know, not like a deep flesh color.
Okay.
But like... like a mom about to give birth nipple.
They're like, so like.
So actually, no, they bursting, are deep in color. Yeah.
Bursting with milk.
And probably bursting with milk.
Leaky nips.
Leaky nips that you don't want to see, and you accidentally see it when you stumble into your mom's room a little too soon and you're asking what's for dinner. That's the nip.
I would have also given it a 4.5 nip rating. For the, I'm just going to piggyback and steal your...
Yeah, please.
And this just might be true of that area of the country. I doubt there's much diversity.
Right.
We don't see any women of color. It's nice that we see, like, all the women aren't these, like, hot Hollywood. Look how hot I am. Everyone's just, like, nice and normal looking. And,
it seems like a lot of tertiary characters were from Fargo.
Yeah, probably.
Like, I guess, including Jean.
So, yeah, it's just probably that there's no diversity in this town that we don't see any women of color. I like that Marge is, like, probably 40, late
30s. Yeah.
Because women of color, women over the age of like 40 and 50 are even more poorly represented than white women.
True.
But yeah, so 4.5. Beautiful nipples. I can't go.
I'm going to give it 4.5 as well because I love a good bandwagon, and also I agree. Mm. Mine are going to be Marge nipples as well, but these ones are radiating beams of light.
Ooh, I like that.
Just blinding.
I feel like that's a future pop culture themed art show.
Ugh. Yes, just Marge.
There should be a Coen Brothers art show!
With just Marge's, just a statue of Marge. But there are very strong lights where her nips should be. That is something I would really make into a Facebook profile picture, I think.
Yeah.
Highest compliment.
That'd be
possible.
So good.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you have it. Fargo, across the board, 4.5.
Love it. I think that's the best
Marge
one
nipple.
So far.
Yeah.
Woo, so.
Yeah.
Did it.
What an honor.
So thanks for bringing us this great
movie,
Julie.
Thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So
is there anything that you'd like to plug, or like where can people find you online?
Yeah.
How do people follow you?
Oh my gosh. You can find me at twitter.com/Julia Prescott. There I post my musings and my show dates, and then I have a podcast about The Simpsons called Everything's Coming Up Podcast. You can find us at Simpsons Pod and on iTunes.
Wonderful.
Very cool. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. If you want to follow us, the Bechdel Cast, you can do
They're cheering for us.
On Twitter. Yeah, they are cheering.
Amazing.
You can follow us at Bechdel Cast on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You can email us if you want, thebechdelcast@gmail.com. And
we love you.
We love you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Ladies and gentlemen.
We are coming back to Atlanta. Right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars, because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, Centratech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed,
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.